You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
A non-resident fellow at the Centre on the US and Europe here at Brookings, originally from the Centre for European Reform in London. It is my pleasure to welcome you here for the second panel of today's event on the future of non-strategic nuclear weapons within the NATO alliance. The discussions over the first panel clearly seem to indicate that there is a strong likelihood that the DDPR process will not allow NATO allies, will not be the opportunity for NATO allies to address some of the difficult questions that are facing them on the future of non-strategic nuclear weapons within the alliance. There seems to be a high likelihood that they will try and push these difficult decisions further down the line. And so this second panel will look at the next decade, so we'll be looking beyond Chicago, and over this time period where it will become increasingly difficult for NATO allies to be able to ignore these key questions, not least because some of the military capabilities which are required for NATO to be able to maintain its non-strategic nuclear weapons capability will need to be renewed. So a lot of the dual-capable aircraft will need to be renewed. The key decisions need to be made in that area. So we will therefore, over the course of the next hour and a half, discuss what is likely to happen over this next decade and how indeed should European countries and the United States go about attempting to maintain deterrence and reassurance in an alliance where there's just so much disagreement about the merit of non-strategic nuclear weapons. To discuss these issues, we are very fortunate to have four prominent experts, which I would very much like to welcome this afternoon. From my direct right outwards, we have Paul Schultz, non-resident senior associate at the Nuclear Policy Program at Carnegie, Steve Pfeiffer, senior fellow at the Centre on the United States and Europe here at Brookings, Malcolm Chalmers, research director at RUSI in London, and George Perkovich, vice president for studies and director of the Nuclear Policy Program at Carnegie. As was mentioned earlier on, these four experts have just recently published a report which is looking at exactly the issue we'll be discussing now, looking beyond the Chicago summit, discussing indeed what the future for nuclear weapons in Europe looks like. And hopefully we'll be able to explore some of the key findings that they discuss in this report. In terms of how we will proceed, George Perkovich will speak first and offer a few opening remarks for up to about 7 to 8 minutes, which are designed to frame the current debate. Then Malcolm Chalmers will offer some thoughts on some of the key considerations that emanated from the DDPR debate relating to the notions of deterrence, burden sharing, and reassurance. Steve Pfeiffer will then lay out some of the challenges and scenarios regarding the future of dual-capable aircraft within Europe. And Paul Schultz will then close by discussing some of the options for strengthening non-nuclear reassurance within the alliance, if indeed NATO allies are to scale back their nuclear means. Once the various panellists have made their opening remarks, we will open up the debate to the floor. And on that, George, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Clara, and thank you all for joining, and those of you who this is going on to your third hour of NATO nuclear things, you might want to think about that. but it's hot out. So, I also want to begin by saying we had a fifth colleague who was extremely important to this process, Jacqueline Tandler, to whom we're grateful for her contributions. You spent a couple of hours talking about a number of the issues and the sources of tension or the considerations that need to be resolved over the nuclear issue in the context of defense and deterrence and the DDPR. And so I'm not going to repeat those here. I just want to talk a little bit about the framework of the paper that we collaborate on. And it was a remarkably constructive and efficient collaboration. But the idea of framing in terms of looking beyond Chicago was that for reasons that, again, were discussed in the earlier session about, you know, Afghanistan, budgetary crisis, all the other priorities that are affecting the leaders of the NATO governments, you know, we didn't expect that there would be a resolution of the fundamental issues that you talked about earlier and that we'll talk about a little more here. And yet there's also a natural tendency, the way these things work is you have a big summit. There's a lot of work in the ramp up to that. Once the summit is done, it's like giving birth to an elephant, which I can only imagine. And I would imagine that after doing that, you would want to rest for a while and think about other things than producing more elephants. And so there will be a natural tendency after Chicago for people to say, okay, we got through that, crisis averted, things papered over, what have you. Let's forget about it for a while. And our view was actually that the issues that we're going to talk about, having to do with replacement of the DCA, maintaining the shared responsibility for the nuclear role for NATO, very concrete issues of reassurance, all of those issues are too important but also too difficult to effect in a short time to allow them to be put off after Chicago, which would be the natural tendency. So we cast this in terms of looking beyond Chicago and are having this event now and publishing the paper now in hopes that perhaps in Chicago there may be made there a commitment to keep the focus going within NATO, to keep active work within the bureaucracy and with each of these states on these hard issues that need to be resolved, rather than putting them off for 3 years or 5 years where the resolution probably won't be any clearer. So that was kind of the conception of the way we did this. And then the paper and our thinking about it concentrated on two questions, and they're in the paper, but I think they may be a little verbose, but there's some subtlety and importance in the formulation. So the first question that we address, but we think needs to be on that agenda after Chicago and very actively worked on, is that given the difficulties involved in maintaining the nuclear status quo in NATO, and those difficulties, again, as you discussed earlier, some of it have to do with the infrastructure, the delivery systems, their aging, the decisions required to do that, but also the status quo is challenged from different directions in favor of disarmament, concerns from the CEE states. So the status quo is going to be difficult to maintain. Well, given that, what alternative forms of nuclear sharing and basing might be available that could simultaneously meet the three key requirements? One, of wide participation in the nuclear mission. Two, reassurance for those states that are seen as most vulnerable. And three, making a significant contribution to the wider disarmament effort. And those three things are difficult to reconcile, but that's one of the key questions we're trying to address. And then the second question is, what means, if any, can be deployed to bolster non-nuclear reassurance of those allies that feel most exposed to external threat? Now, again, there's a lot of work been done on that. There are a lot of possible answers, but we want to go beyond that. So, well, who's going to provide those means, and when are they going to do it? And if European nuclear and nuclear basing members of the alliance choose not to renew their commitments to base and delivered forward-deployed weapons, in the absence of an alliance consensus on removing them, so in other words, a few states are making decisions in the absence of a consensus on removal, how can NATO then demonstrate a credible conventional reassurance, again, to the most exposed members? Others have asked those questions. I think the paper and in the presentations you hear, we go into them, I think, in fairly good depth with I think mindful, we try to be mindful of the legitimate differing interests of the states involved. And we noticed one of the reasons to do this work was that, you know, there's a tendency amongst some of those whose emphasis is on, let's just remove the weapons, withdraw them. There tends to then be kind of an elision or gliding over about what they would then do to substitute for the reassurance that the more exposed members of the alliance want. And so we're trying to be more concrete about, okay, what is feasible. It's nice to say, well, we'll figure out something. But if you're feeling exposed and vulnerable, you want more than that. And so we try to work on that. We've also found that some of those more exposed states who really want to maintain the forward deployed force aren't contributing even the 2% of their budgets to defense that could be useful then in bolstering up the non-nuclear assurances. So on the one hand, that's a free riding potential problem. But then others who want to maintain the status quo don't have much to say then about contributing either to the disarmament objective or the non-proliferation obligations that some states feel. So we've tried to take all of that into account and then address each of these issues in a fair amount of detail. Clara outlined kind of who did what. So I think kind of with that framing, I would turn it over to Malcolm, who kind of distills, you know, what we and many of you have been hearing over the last few years in terms of the debate on this set of issues.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank Malcolm. You, Sarah. As we wrote this paper, I think we became more convinced, I certainly did, that NATO's formulation about what the question is in terms of what the appropriate mix is between nuclear and conventional and missile defense was actually quite a useful way of structuring this question. And the conclusions we came up with in our paper were about how the appropriate mix might change in relation to both nuclear and conventional. But I wanted to start really with an observation about the title of the review, the deterrence and defense posture review. And I think one of the challenges in relation to the nuclear component of the appropriate mix is it's quite hard to get a handle on what the defense role of those weapons is, or what people think it should be. And we very deliberately asked a lot of people when we were preparing this paper what they saw the operational role of these weapons being. And we did get some answers which suggested that there might be an operational role. And in particular, I think, as a form of signaling prior to moving to the use of strategic weapons is not a new rationale, but it's a residual rationale, which for some people we talked to still had some merit. So it's not that there is nobody that says there's any operational role, but it's pretty clear, I think, from being involved in this issue for years and talking to many of those people much more directly involved in the operations, that that's not the driving force for these weapons. And it's probably not even really centrally about deterrence, although there's a deterrence and defense posture review. Deterrence is not really the driving force for the sort of non-strategic nuclear force we have. One of the things we argue in the paper is that even if you accept that signaling rationale, the need to signal with a small number of weapons before escalation in a situation where you think nuclear use is an option, it would need a much smaller force. I mean, Tom referred to this in the last session in relation to the Russia-China dyad. But for NATO, if there were such a rationale, you're not talking about using dozens and dozens of weapons. You're talking about much smaller numbers. So we asked a question in our paper about that. No, I think what we argued really is that the real debate about the appropriate mix isn't about deterrence and defense, in a pure sense at least. It's about four more political factors, each of which points to a different conclusion, a desirable conclusion, and each of which has its own supporters in different NATO member states. And I just wanted to structure my remarks about what those four political factors are, bearing in mind, of course, that there is still a defense and deterrence core in the debate. The first, clearly, is the nuclear disarmament point. The primary reason why this issue is high on the agenda is because of that very clear German government statement. And that German government statement was driven by a view that NATO should be doing more on the nuclear disarmament front. And it's not about costs. We talked about costs earlier. There are some costs involved, but if the Germans, as we say in the paper, if the rest of NATO, the United States, offered to pay all the costs that Germany might incur from nuclear modernization, it probably wouldn't make very much difference to the German political debate. It's more about a view that NATO should be doing as much as it can on disarmament, especially in relation to weapons which, from their point of view, have no clear value. These weapons were in the front line during the Cold War. They are no longer in that position. So that's the first and, I think, important political driver for this debate, and, of course, points to a particular conclusion. A second political driver, which I think is also important, is reassurance vis-à-vis Russia, which is not the same as that first point. It may overlap it, but it's not the same point. If that wasn't an issue, if we didn't have a NATO-Russia founding act, then we could simply move the weapons from those countries that don't want them to those countries that do, and from the front line we had in 1985 to the front line, in inverted commas, that we have today, whether that's on the Turkey-Iranian border or the Estonian-Russian border. And even saying that, of course, makes pretty clear those are not front lines in the sense that the inner German border was in the 1980s. But not only do we have a clear commitment not to do that in the NATO-Russia Founding Act, but it would be highly provocative and not something anybody in the current state of NATO-Russia relations would want to contemplate. So reassuring Russia blocks off many of the options, and I think rightly so. The third political factor is the need to respond to concerns about burden sharing, which are primarily American concerns. And that's the main driver for the current shape of the American nuclear presence in Europe. It's not an operational reason that we have it based, we're told, have American nuclear weapons in Europe based in five countries rather than one or two. It's driven mainly, I think we would argue, by American concerns that as long as NATO's a nuclear alliance, there should be a sharing of the responsibilities for that role. And there are some rather less visible support aspects to that: area refueling, suppression of enemy air defences, etc., conventional elements of that nuclear role. But the most visible, although not always acknowledged, but it's pretty visible in this debate, is the most visible aspect of that burden sharing is the basing of American nuclear weapons on your territory and involvement of your aircraft potentially in strike roles. So that's the third political aspect. And here we argue that there may be scope for change and alteration, which should be put into that appropriate mixed discussion. And we articulate options, and I apologize in advance for this, but for smart sharing. Are there ways to think creatively about how sharing is organized or not? And are there ways in which, if it comes to it, sharing could continue without German or Belgian, perhaps Dutch aircraft involved or not? And this is about politics. It's about sharing the political burden. It's not least, I think, about American perceptions of the desirability from an American point of view of a situation which the number of states with a very direct and visible engagement in this mission was less. And we talk about options that might involve European pilots serving in American squadrons in Italy or serving in American squadrons back here in the US. And are those just going to be viewed as fig leaves here, or are they going to be viewed as something more credible? And we also argue, finally, on this particular aspect, that we don't think it's impossible for NATO, were these weapons only to be based in the United States or to be withdrawn from Europe, we don't think it's impossible in those circumstances for NATO to agree to their return to Europe in the event of conflict. And that's something people argue about quite a lot. And we make the case that if we are basing this structure on the assumption that NATO might be able to agree by consensus to the release of these weapons in times of war, then it's not less incredible for them in times of war to agree as a signal prior to nuclear use for some of those weapons to be returned to Europe. Now, both are incredible because the sort of war that in which nuclear use might be contemplated is so remote in Europe anyway. but I think to dismiss the US basing simply on the basis of that argument, I don't think we felt was credible. There are other arguments clearly on that. And such a consolidation or withdrawal would have advantages in relation to the first two criteria. And finally and fourthly, we argue that there's a political requirement to respond to the reassurance needs of the most exposed states, most of all the Baltic states and Turkey and Poland, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent. And in our paper, and Paul will talk more about this, so I'll be very brief, we articulate ways in which that reassurance might be strengthened in ways which are compatible with changes in nuclear posture, though, and indeed likely changes in nuclear posture. And in principle, it shouldn't be so hard to enhance reassurance to those more exposed states, given the relatively limited nature of the threats that are faced. And the limited amounts which the Baltic states, and in particular, spend on their own defence, suggest that they are not overly alarmed about a traditional invasion threat of the sort that one normally associates with a possible nuclear response. But I think it is the case that after a decade in which the United States and other NATO countries were focused on Afghanistan, and we're now talking about a pivot to a part of the world even further away from Europe than Afghanistan to East Asia, there is a concern amongst the more exposed states in Europe that the United States in particular, but perhaps also some other European countries in Western Europe, don't take Article 5 guarantees to those states seriously. And if new risks, new threats were developed in future, that they would be left on their own. And that's the context in which there's a concern that any removal of any symbols of American presence in Europe are viewed in those states. So to conclude, on the basis of those four essentially political drivers of this debate, we put forward some ideas about how the appropriate mix of nuclear and conventional should be changed, both in relation to nuclear and in relation to conventional, in a way which we think doesn't provide a perfect solution, but perhaps moves NATO forward and provides some potential for building a more consensus on this issue than there is at present. Thanks, Claire.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. Steve?
Great. No, thank you. I'm going to talk and focus it on the question of dual-capable aircraft from the point that right now when you're talking about NATO non-strategic nuclear weapons, we're referring to American B-61 bombs forward deployed in Europe and the aircraft that are certified, wired for delivery of them. And again, according to the Federation of American Scientists, what we're talking about are nuclear weapons deployed in Turkey, Italy, Germany, Belgium, and Netherlands, for use by the air forces of the United States, Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, and Italy. But as NATO looks through the deterrence and defense posture view, there's an elephant in the room or right outside the door, which I think in Chicago they can probably overlook for the next 5 years. But if you're looking down the road 10 years, there is a question, could NATO sustain its current posture with regards to dual-capable aircraft? And I think our analytical view is that 10 years from now, NATO's posture is likely to look different than it does today, because national decisions have been taken and are being taken about replacing the current generation of aircraft with a successor aircraft, which may or may not have the capability to deliver nuclear weapons. And that, in turn, can have an impact on things such as the alliance's ability to reassure those allies that feel vulnerable. So let me just talk briefly about what's happening just in hardware terms. I mean, in the case of the U.S. Air Force, it's pretty clear. The nuclear posture review specified that the United States will maintain a capability to forward deploy fighter bombers that are dual capable, and the plan is that the F-35 will succeed the F-16 in that role. But when you look to other NATO air forces, you get some different answers. For example, in the case of Germany, the German Air Force currently plans to fly the Tornado, which is dual capable, to beyond 2020. They've not yet articulated a specific end date. But originally, you know, several years ago, you heard that the original plan was to retire the Tornadoes around 2015, 2018. So they are extending that. And they're extending that because when the Tornado goes away, the replacement is the Eurofighter, and the Eurofighter is now not planned to be wired for nuclear weapons. And given the political sentiment in Germany, I think it's virtually impossible to see a decision by the German government to give the Eurofighter a nuclear capability. When I was there in November, one person made the observation, they said, look, nuclear weapons are now not a controversial issue in Germany, even though there's a fairly strong anti-nuclear sentiment here, because everyone understands when the tornadoes go away, the American nuclear weapons go away. But if there was a decision to try to give the Eurofighter a nuclear capability, that would immediately make this a very big issue, and they were very dubious that the government could sustain that position. In the case of the Netherlands, the Dutch Air Force is looking at the F-35 to replace the F-16. It hasn't made a final decision yet. But there, too, I think, politically, there's a fairly strong anti-nuclear sentiment. And also, as it becomes clear that the German Air Force is on track to go non-nuclear, that could have a major, if not a decisive, impact on a Dutch decision. In the case of Belgium, the Belgian Air Force at this point has not yet made a decision on replacing the F-16. And there's some talk even that the Belgian Air Force, for financial reasons, may actually abandon the fighter-bomber role. But if they do procure a successor for the F-16 or extend the life of their F-16s, I think the judgment is that the Belgian decision on whether to maintain that nuclear role would likely be impacted by what the Germans and the Dutch do. In the case of Italy, Italy is on track to procure F-35s to replace its dual-capable Tornadoes. And the sense is that the Italian government is probably more ready to maintain a nuclear role, with a bit of nervousness in Rome if it becomes apparent that the northern tier, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands, are moving away from a nuclear role. And finally, in the case of Turkey, it also is talking about the F-35 to replace its F-16s. But as was noted in the first panel, the Turkish Air Force F-16s are believed no longer to have a nuclear role, and it's not clear whether the Turkish government envisages that role for the F-35s. So you're in a situation now with five countries hosting American nuclear weapons and four countries providing dual-capable aircraft where that does spread the burden. It does also then give political cover to those countries. And the question then becomes, if the numbers come down, if the countries hosting weapons is reduced, if the countries that are flying dual-capable aircraft is reduced, how far can that go without generating pressure on the residual countries that might become very hard to bear? So in the paper, we talk about five alternate postures for dual-capable aircraft. But I think in three considerations apply in each case. One is because in each case, you're talking about a reduced posture in terms of fewer countries hosting or weapons or providing dual-capable aircraft. It could have the impact of diminishing reassurance, in the sense that those countries that feel vulnerable are likely to be more assured if they see a wider number of countries hosting weapons and flying dual-capable aircraft. A second issue is that to the extent that those numbers go down in terms of countries hosting or flying dual-capable aircraft, it could raise a question of burden sharing. And one focus would be in the U.S. Congress. If too much of that nuclear burden looks to be borne by just the United States, what kind of questions does that raise within Congress? And then finally, as the numbers go down, I think there's an expectation that that probably increases the chances of political pressure on those countries that are maintaining nuclear roles to follow suit and also move towards a non-nuclear position. So those are some of the considerations. The five alternative postures would be: posture number one is that some European countries, one or two, abandon the dual-capable aircraft role and the B-61 bombs leave those countries, but that other countries maintain the role, as well as U.S. dual-capable aircraft. The second posture would be Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands would abandon the dual-capable aircraft role, and the B-61s would be withdrawn from those countries. But you would still have B-61s remaining in Italy and Turkey. The U.S. would maintain a dual-capable unit in Italy, and the Italian Air Force might also maintain a capability to deliver nuclear weapons. So, again, a smaller capability than in the first alternative, but still having a European engagement with regards to dual-capable aircraft. And the third alternative, you would basically have all of the European air forces drop their dual-capable role, and so it would only be an American unit, the F-16 unit at Aviano in Italy, that would have a dual-capable mission. And you might then take that unit and multilateralize it in the sense that you could assign German, Belgian, Dutch, even Polish pilots to that American unit. And so it would have something of a NATO character. And that might be a way to sort of spread the burden a little bit. But a question that you would have to ask is, would Italy or some other country be prepared to be the only country hosting that single unit and be the only country hosting American nuclear weapons? A fourth alternative, which was talked about, I think, a couple of years ago, although it seems to have fallen out of the discussion, is that NATO might procure its own squadron of dual-capable aircraft, much in the same way that NATO owns and operates a squadron of airborne warning and control system aircraft. And that's an interesting option, but there are some questions. One, buying a group of aircraft will be expensive. Does NATO have the funds from that out of common funds? Second, how would you decide what other roles, because the nuclear role, you wouldn't want to keep aircraft just for the nuclear role. There would have to be other missions that you'd want to use these aircraft for. How would you determine that? And then finally, again, if you have this single squadron, where do you base it and its nuclear weapons? Is there one country that's prepared to be singularized in the sense of hosting those aircraft and those weapons? And then the fifth option would be that Europeans would drop the dual capable aircraft role. All of the B-61 weapons would be brought back from Europe to the United States, and there would be a U.S.-based dual-capable unit that, again, could be multilateral. It could have German, Polish, Dutch exchange pilots. And you could ask of the Europeans that they would maintain some capability in Europe to allow the redeployment to Europe of American dual-capable aircraft and also of B-61 weapons. So you might ask the Germans and the Dutch to maintain the weapon storage vaults and such. So you would have that capability. I think, as Malcolm said, you know, it wouldn't be impossible, but I think the idea in a crisis of moving weapons back to Europe, certainly I think it would be a politically difficult question that would require a lot of consideration within NATO. So when we looked at this, we said there are four or five different alternate postures for NATO dual-capable aircraft compared to the current one. But again, I think in each case, compared to what you have now, it's likely to result in some diminished reassurance to allies. It may raise more questions about nuclear burden sharing within the alliance, particularly within the U.S. Congress, and also to the extent that the number of countries hosting weapons is decreased, it probably generates more political pressure on those countries. And that then led us to think about, are there other ways that you might proceed to provide reassurance in the non-nuclear area?
Thank you very much. And now to Paul.
Thank you. Well, we spelled out as clearly as we thought we could on page 9, in fact, what the operational and political function of these weapons were. You could describe our position as collective agnosticism about whether this was a good idea, whether it's worked, whether it didn't work. We tried not to get into that. But we were sceptical about the sustainability of present arrangements. So we looked at reassurance. If this was to change, if NATO would negotiate with itself, as it tends to do, to come up with a different appropriate mix, how could that be done with a harmonious outcome? What would be the way of not tearing or at least stressing the alliance? We didn't think that this was an issue which would tear the alliance apart. It's significant that we didn't think it was first order, but obviously we should be interested in maintaining maximum cohesion in the alliance. And that got into it required thinking about reassurance, which is notoriously harder and more complicated than deterrent. It's like deterrent, it's subjectivity squared. If you don't really know what deters the other side, how do you really know what should reassure alliance members about what they think reassures deters a potential enemy? The issues are a bit subterranean as well as subjective, because this is not something we discovered is very openly talked about. The alliance negotiations on this have been conducted behind closed doors, because this is sensitive emotional stuff. Countries fear that other countries are not rational about this, not reasonable. Bombs are not bombs or bombs. They're indicators. They're Rorschach tests. Who is entitled to say, for example, although in our discussions we heard, the Baltics are being hysterical because of the past, the Germans are being compulsively de-bellicized pacifists seeking deals with Russia, the Russians are paranoid because of their approach to nuclear weapons. who is entitled to reach these judgments? It didn't seem to us very fruitful to go into that. So we tried to go with understanding and not criticizing other people, other strategic cultures. It was clear, however, that the attitude to forward-based American nuclear weapons was, in some ways, for some groups, a kind of surrogate for attitudes to Russia, attitudes to the dependability of the US alliance in general. So bigger things were projected onto these bombs than just the bombs themselves. The people who were most open and found it easiest to be absolutely certain and outspoken were the anti-nuclear movement and the peace movement. And they were worried about the whole discourse of reassurance, because they could see that just as an excuse to do nothing. And that prejudiced what they saw was the glittering possibility here, which is to unfreeze political relationships between Russia and NATO by removing this weapons category. But we tried to be as clinical as we could. We looked at the fact that this is not something in the abstract. The possibility of reassurance of exposed allies depends on general international atmospherics between NATO and its neighbours, and atmospherics within NATO. How good are America's relationships with its European allies? We looked at ways which could improve those atmospherics, revival, greater Russian transparency about their numbers, which we thought perhaps were not as great as had been estimated, some relocation, though not in the way that frightened the Japanese or the Chinese. There needs to be a very precise bit of Russia where you could put weapons which didn't scare people to the east, and the revival of CFE, so the reduction of fears of surprise at conventional attack would be reassuring. And even the beginning of some process of Russian-American strategic arms control, which would necessarily have implications for tactical nuclear weapons. That would be encouraging. Iran, though, as a neighbour with whom there are atmospherics, was something would also need to be taken into account, but there was almost nothing that could be said about this at the moment. The Turks don't want to talk about it. Nobody actually knows yet how Russia should think about Iran, what kind of an Iran it would be, but that's a problem on the horizon. The greater the alliance cohesion, the greater the alliance self-confidence, the greater the reassurance, or the less need for reassurance, because countries on the edge of an alliance like that would feel that they wouldn't be abandoned, that they wouldn't be intimidated, because the alliance was together, it was effective, it was meeting all its members' needs. But if the alliance, on the other hand, ceased to be as interested in projecting power and world order beyond its borders, like if it fell back from Afghanistan, an unconcealable failure in Afghanistan, saying in effect we'll never do that again, that wouldn't perhaps necessarily be bad for reassurance in this aspect for collective defence. It might lead to the greater re-emphasis on collective security, which the easternmost members have tended to prefer. What can we do within the alliance? This question that George mentioned, who could do what and in what timescale and at what expense? We looked at declaratory statements, speeches, diplomatic attention. We thought that one possible slogan for this would be a bias toward but not a veto for the most exposed, a way of emphasising that those countries would get collective attention. And we looked at the case for additional statements, particularly by the US. But we found there were limits to that. There gets to be a frantic quality if after having already signed up to Article 5, you then say, but yes, we really, really do mean it. it's self-defeating. The next set of things we looked at were visible, symbolic, on the ground, but somewhat symbolic capacities. That would be, for example, enhancing the Baltic Air policing mission, building new HQs and operational centres and agencies, putting assets, visible things on the ground in the most exposed countries, which might make their people feel more confident, partly because they would feel that if they were ever attacked, it would be a certainty that everyone else would join in to defend them. We were particularly intrigued by the USAF's deployment of small numbers of logisticians and support personnel for F-16s and C-130s into Poland. This might be a model for other countries to adopt. We were agnostic, I think, about missile defense, putting those assets in. It's certainly an involving thing to do, but it also potentially raises Russian antagonism and belligerence. So maybe the impact on reassurance would be neutral or hard to calculate. More important was militarily significant conventional reassurances, where we're getting Norwegian defense ministers saying this year NATO's ability to defend its member states is questionable and might deteriorate further. So that there are clearly things to do, building up infrastructures for civil and military transport, air bases, sea basing, air defense radars, training, exercising, live firing, really significant, believable scenarios with the NATO response force. Greater contingency planning, which has been a NATO anathema in the past. We're now beginning to do contingency planning, and that could be done for different kinds of conventional and unconventional conflicts. Politically sensitive, but probably worth addressing. And above all, showing that East European states could improve their capacity to receive reinforcements and other NATO members could improve their capacity to send them. But we felt that there were limits to how far one could or should or will be likely to go in this kind of conventional enhancement, A, because NATO can't afford it, and B, because if you really started doing this seriously in a way which negated Russian conventional capabilities completely, nothing could be more calculated to drive Russia into anxiety and arms racing. So at the end, we concluded that this would not be easy, but there was a spectrum of possible reassurance measures, and they have varying costs, and they're uncertain in prospect. And it will depend fundamentally what the conditions at the time are when these are considered, and we can't know about that because we don't know about the tempo of what may happen to the NATO nuclear assets. But the aim, we thought, should be a determined, carefully considered mix of investments, deployments, exercises, visits, speeches, and statements to address the reasonable concerns of the most exposed allies. And in the worst case, you don't do that. You just, for domestic reasons, some key allies go to rapid reductions, but at the same time, exposed allies, nuclear reassurance demandeurs, I suppose we could call them, demand ill-justified, arduous, and provocative reassurance measures, and you get a complete failure to meet minds. That's avoidable, we thought, and it needs to be avoided by thinking about these things, if not now, pretty soon after the Chicago summit.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you to all the panellists. We now have about an hour for Q&A. Before turning to the floor, if I may, I will just ask two questions to the panellists to get their views. The first one, touches upon the issues of what are these non-strategic nuclear weapons for, and it's basically whom should we be envisaging that they should be used against? There was quite a lot of talk in the previous panel, of course, of Russia and the extent to which Russia was or was no longer really someone or a country against whom these weapons might be required. But I was wondering, what about the other countries in the world? I mean, we've touched slightly upon Iran, but indeed, is Iran a country that we might want to envisage over the next decade that we would want to consider that those weapons might be useful in any ways? And to what extent do we want to be bearing in mind trends in nuclear developments in other countries within the world? In any of these countries, are non-strategic nuclear weapons relevant or not? Then the second question is simply regarding the debate on reassurances. You touched upon, Paul, the fact that, of course, it'll be tough because a lot of the allies who want to withdraw or scale back NATO's nuclear posture, also those who believe that they're just... The whole argument is they think that there's no need for nuclear weapons, but as a byproduct, that there's therefore also no need for reassurances, because that implies you need to reassure that there's a challenge to reassure against. And so to what extent do we expect that it'll be politically feasible to really push through certain reassurances which could really carry weight with those that are concerned? Or seeing it another way, is there really any scope for NATO to address these matters about the future of its nuclear posture without addressing the broader debate of, well, what is it trying to do in this post-Cold War world 20 years down the line, touching upon some of the issues that Leah Michel mentioned earlier today, about there is so much disagreement amongst the alliance about what the threats are and what it's trying to do. Is it necessary to answer that debate beforehand? And seeing that it's so incredibly difficult for NATO to do so, what prospects are we really seeing for the future? So, if anyone had any views.
I would take a stab on that one part. What are they for in terms of who's being deterred? I think it's both totally superfluous but also extremely counterproductive to talk about and operationalize the idea of forward deployed U.S. nuclear weapons in NATO being used against Iran. It's superfluous because Iran doesn't have a conventional military capability to speak of. It's utterly incapable of invading or occupying anybody around it. Has not done so in its history. And so the logic that we've had in NATO for all these years, well, you need these forces as kind of an equalizer, a rapid response to a severely degraded position in a conventional threat. That doesn't, it's basically impossible to imagine that vis-a-vis Iran. And you say, well, okay, but if Iran has nuclear weapons, well, even there, the scenarios where Iran has that capability and then mounts the kind of offensive operations for which nuclear weapons would be a retaliation. Again, don't know anybody who's ever come up with a scenario like that. But they don't have nuclear weapons. And so if you were to anticipate that and speak about it too soon, you play into the worst. You weaken your position politically to isolate Iran and everything else because now it looks like NATO's threatening Iran with nuclear weapons. So maybe Iran needs to get nuclear weapons. So in any case, you would have to be very delayed in that. So I think that's just a totally dead end. And I understand why some people may argue it, but I think it doesn't withstand analysis. So to me, that ends up being, well, it's kind of, you know, I mean, we talk about it a little bit in the paper. I mean, there may be a scenario in Estonia where we can imagine a quick Russian conventional operation that does, you know, takes a little piece of Estonia to send a message or something like that, and NATO can't get there in time. I mean, so it's Russia and it's a limited conventional incursion, which doesn't seem very plausible either, but that, to my mind, was the one that was the most plausible, which then demanded the most reassurance, which basically is to Estonia. I mean, that was.
Yeah, if I can add to that, I would agree with what George said, and I guess make two additional points. One is, I think in most NATO countries that now host nuclear weapons, I don't think in a place like Germany or Belgium or the Netherlands that they would see their nuclear weapons as helping to deter a nuclear Iran. Turkey might be a different question just because of proximity, but even if you look at the last several years, the Turks have been sort of ambivalent in their views toward Iran. The second question is, if you were trying to construct a U.S. posture to deter an Iran that already had nuclear weapons, again, I'm not sure that the Iranian calculation would be affected by that much by nuclear weapons that have been sitting in Europe for all these years. And that if you really wanted to sort of remind the Iranians that you had a nuclear capability that could be used in a deterrent role, you would probably look for areas that were closer geographically. You know, periodic deployments of B-2 bombers to Diego Garcia, maybe even deploying nuclear capable F-35s into the Persian Gulf from time to time. That would, I think, be a much clearer signal to the Iranians on deterrence than the weapons in Europe.
Sorry, yes.
I thought one way of answering that, or maybe evading that, is to look at the wording we found that we could live with collectively. In extreme circumstances of collective self-defense, the combination of these bombs would allow NATO to decide by consensus to cross the nuclear threshold in a manner that was not purely demonstrative. Now, so the question is, what would be plausible extreme circumstances of collective self-defense? It's not very likely that for the foreseeable future Iran could create those possibilities. in the longer term, who knows, but I take George's point that it's unwise to talk very much about this. With Russia, you could imagine very, very implausibly, but not impossibly, such extreme circumstances. So, inescapably, although not wanting to singularize Russia, that looks as though, and that is clearly the place where these capabilities are most discussed about.
And Malcolm, you wanted to add something?
Very briefly. A posture review has to be for the next 5 or 10 years, not for the next 30 or 40 years. Otherwise, that way lies madness. But on the second point, on reassurance, I think it's actually quite important, and certainly this is what we're saying in the paper, that the reassurance measures we're talking about in relation to the most exposed states are worthwhile in their own right. They're not there as a compensation for something happening on the nuclear side. And I think it'd be very dangerous if we sent out the message to the most exposed states that we're only interested in reassuring them as long as there's a nuclear issue. Because then they will feel that it's in their interest to keep the nuclear issue boiling because it's the only way they're going to get the Americans or the Brits or the other people interested in their security, which is absolutely not the case. What I think we are doing is we're in a situation in which these countries joined NATO a decade ago. In almost all the period of their membership, NATO has been focusing on operations in Afghanistan and elsewhere and not on Europe. And they've been festering along, and had, I think, legitimate worries about, hang on, we're members of NATO, but it doesn't really feel like it. Are there things we can do in that respect? Now, if we succeed in bolstering reassurance in that, which we should be doing anyway, then it will make them feel rather more comfortable about a realignment of the nuclear posture in a way which others are pushing for. But that's not the reason we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, sorry, you might want to wait for the microphone. And also, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Rachel Oswald with Global Security Newswire again. It was mentioned in the previous panel that there's the sense within NATO that it's the United States that would be the key decision maker on the decision to keep tactical nukes in Europe. But from what was just previously said, it sounds like it comes down to a domino effect of Germany, then Netherlands and Belgium kind of being the cause of the withdrawal of U.S. nuclear weapons. Is there a discrepancy there? Am I misunderstanding something?
Yes.
You know, I think the German power in Europe is a really interesting question and has been ever since Germany became a unified state. And I think when Germany, after World War II, part of the settlement in Europe has been about German self-restraint and about Germany not wanting to use its full potential power. But wanting things to be done in a multilateral context. And that's starting to change in the economic sphere very clearly. But I think in the security sphere, it's still a very strong element in the security settlement. And for Europeans, NATO is not only, I think probably even not primarily about mobilization of forces for operations. It's also about denationalization of security in Europe. And a way of working which makes people feel comfortable about sharing security with others. And that's why the Germans, having put this issue out there and made it pretty clear where they stand in the long term, have also made it clear that they don't want to force the pace on this to such an extent that it makes everybody else feel uneasy, not simply about the substance of the question, but about Germany. they would prefer, I think the Germans have made it very clear, they would prefer there to be an extended NATO discussion on this, which at the end of the process means there are no nuclear weapons in German territory. But they're not going to suddenly tomorrow after the next election say they're out. And sometimes maybe that was a message that was sent in the beginning which was very unhelpful. But the fact that Germany's putting that out there and some other of the basin countries are putting that out there but not saying they're going to force the issue, means it's a question about how this issue is going to, in the end, be resolved in an alliance which is based on consensus. And historically, what's happened within NATO is that while there is consensus, while everybody has to be listened to, nevertheless, there's a recognition amongst most member states that power does give a disproportionate say to some countries rather than others, and that if you've got a situation which the US, France, Germany and the UK agreed on a particular way of doing things, then other states would have to feel very strongly indeed that it was in their particular national interest to go against such a consensus. And even within that group of four, I think the United States, on this issue at least, has a particular leadership role to play because they're American weapons. The American nuclear guarantee is what the exposed states are worried about. I mean, to the extent that Estonia or Poland wants extended nuclear deterrence, they don't want German or Belgian extended nuclear deterrence or aircraft. They want American extended nuclear deterrence. So Americans are damned if they do and damned if they don't. The Europeans ask for leadership, and then when they get it, they say, well, you didn't consult us properly. Well, you know, that's life. You want to lead a global empire, you just have to get used to it. And that's the way things work. And what NATO does, I think, is, when it works well, it has the right balance between consultation and leadership. But this is not an alliance of equals. It's an alliance led by the United States, and that's the way it is. So maybe that's a roundabout way of saying this US-Germany are in totally different positions as a result of World War II, and I think we're allowed to continue to make decisions in that way.
Thank you. Steve?
Yeah, let me make two points. I mean, on NATO and consensus, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the German government agrees, as do all allies, that they're going to solve these issues on the basis of consensus, that any decisions on nuclear posture will be a result of the work around the council. But having said that, you know, at some point, the tornadoes will stop flying. And my analytical judgment is that I cannot see Germany maintaining a nuclear-capable role once the tornadoes go away. And there may be an inconsistency between consensus and where the German Air Force is going that at some point down the road causes a contradiction. The second, kind of build on Malcolm's point about the United States and consultations, and I remember when I was still in the State Department, sort of U.S. consultations, often with NATO it was the U.S. going and telling the Allies, this is what we want to do, and consulting meant securing their agreement to that U.S. position. I think actually in recent years the United States has become, on some issues, more prepared to consult in the traditional sense, where it goes and may express a view, but it really is seeking Allied positions. In the run-up to the Lisbon summit, I spent a couple of days at NATO headquarters and talked to, officials from maybe 8 or 9 different NATO missions, and it was across the spectrum, including countries that I think wanted to see change in NATO's nuclear posture and countries that did not want to see change in NATO's nuclear posture as they were finalizing the strategic concept in 2010. But what was interesting to me was what most of those countries said was, you know, the United States government is really kind of letting us Europeans decide. That in fact, I heard from a number that they thought the U.S. government is really not engaged in this. Now, I heard separately from American officials, no, we were there. But at least the impression among a number of the European missions was that on this particular issue, the United States was prepared to let Europe to see if it could come to a consensus and then deal with that consensus. My own guess is that if the Europeans had then, or in the run-up to Chicago, if European allies came to the United States and said, we all agree we no longer see a need for American nuclear weapons in Europe, I think the United States government would agree in a heartbeat to withdraw those weapons. And my own sense from talking to U.S. officials is, again, the U.S. view of nuclear weapons in Europe is driven less by the requirement to deter somebody and more by the requirement to reassure those allies who still feel that those weapons have an important deterrent role.
Steve, don't you think burden sharing is still a consideration for the Americans?
Oh, that certainly is.
And that, if they'd agreed in a heartbeat, if the Europeans agreed, then the burden sharing issue wouldn't be there.
I think that would be an issue, but I think if there was a consensus view among Europeans that the weapons were no longer required, it's very difficult for me to see Washington trying to persuade Europe to keep weapons if Europe says they don't want them any further. Mm-hmm. And that may well have then some negative blowback in terms of the congressional view on burden sharing within the nuclear role falling almost solely on the United States. But I don't see it coming out of the end of the way.
Thank you. And Paul?
Everything I've picked up suggests the US really is interested in letting the Europeans decide what they want, although it's not absolutely clear that the US is a completely unitary actor on this. Some of you in the audience may have a better sense than I do, but I don't think it's necessarily the case that state and DOD see it in the same way, and within state, whether the US mission in NATO sees it the same way as Foggy Bottom. But I don't know. However, we shouldn't forget that there's France in this, and to the extent that Germany has gone anti-nuclear, France has become perhaps more insistently pro-nuclear behind the scenes and will play a hard, determined game with very little internal opposition to French pro-nuclear positions. But finally, there's a historical survey of an earlier examination of NATO tactical nuclear policy and in enhanced radiation weapons in the 70s, in which the author concludes that the moral of all this is that modernization of of tactical nuclear weapons is impossible without firm, determined American leadership and support. Now, without that, and we are talking about continuation through modernization. It's only through modernization of aircraft, because they tiresomely wear out, that you can maintain existing positions. Without that determined American leadership, the implication of that statement, though it wasn't predictive, it wasn't intended to be, but might be, is that it will not happen, and that therefore, and this is the kind of skeptical tone we take in our report, that the arrangements will fall away because they won't be modernized and won't be sustainable.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, at the back, sir.
Stanley Kober, I just wonder what economic assumptions underlie all your projections here. Given the economic crisis, how much money do you think the NATO countries will have to spend on defense that will be able to do all these things?
Let me make one observation here, which is that I think at least some NATO air forces will maintain a fighter-bomber capability after the current generation of Tornadoes and F-16s are retired. Maybe not all the countries that fly them today, but the Germans will have the Eurofighter. It's likely, I think, that the Netherlands and Italy will have F-35s.
Can I be more specific? Yeah. Could you just give me a number, like percent of GDP? 5 years out, what do you think the percent of GDP will be?
Well, I can tell you right now, NATO has set for itself a goal that each ally spend 2% of its gross domestic product on defense. Right now, the countries that meet that goal are the United States, Britain, France, Greece, and Albania. And I would suspect that those numbers are going to go down over the next few years. The point I was making, though, on aircraft is, I suspect the aircraft will be there. The actual wiring, the things that you have to do to an airplane to make it dual capable, are a relatively small proportion of the total aircraft cost. The question about whether or not to have an aircraft with a dual capable capability, I suspect, is not going to be driven so much by cost concerns as it will by political decisions.
Well, and there also is an issue of, it's not clear what the implication of all that is. In other words, if reassurance and actually building a conventional capability that would actually be more credible, less of a moral hazard, more usable and everything else, actually costs more than just doing nothing, you may actually keep the nuclear forces longer, drag it out and so on, and get a lot less usable deterrent, but it's easier economically. Think about the financial crisis. You require more reserves to be in the banks because they're exposed and everything else. But if things are coming down, where do you get that? You say, well, all right, we won't raise the reserve requirements because that's hard to do. So you just keep the exposure out there. That could be the result too.
Can I?
Yes, Malcolm.
Some sense of the numbers. I think the German defense budget is something of the order of 35 billion euros or so. We're talking, the numbers that people have out there are in order to pay for a new kit for their Eurofighter, which would allow them to use nuclear weapons. You might be talking about a few hundred million euros over a number of years. And in order to maintain some Tornadoes for a bit longer, which you would not otherwise have simply for the nuclear role. Again, it might be something of that same order. So even if you add those two together and make some pretty, you know, topside assumptions, you're talking about per year 100 million euros or something of that sort, which you wouldn't otherwise have to spend on the nuclear role for Germany out of a budget of 30, so it's 1-3% of the total German defense budget. So I don't think for the Europeans and Germany, it's likely to be particularly expensive because they're talking about a unique aircraft. The other European countries are talking about F-35s. So they're buying a kit off the Americans. The Germans would have to design or at least pay for their own avionics package. Even for the Germans, it's quite a small proportion of the total. It's not insignificant because money's tight in defense throughout Europe, but it's not overwhelming. The bigger costs, I think, are in the United States. I mean, it's the same in missile defense, but certainly in the nuclear area, the Americans are paying, or will, are planning to pay quite significant bucks for a separate nuclear variant for the F-35. Not all F-35s are going to be nuclear capable, but there's going to be a batch of them that are, and that will, you know, that will cost something. It depends. You know, people here will know the numbers on that, but that's something significant. The B-61 modernization will be needed for strategic bombers as well as for the F-35. So how do you allocate the cost of that between the two, assuming if the United States gave up the free-fall nuclear bomb altogether, then, you know, more significant amounts would be saved, but we're getting into broader issues there. But so I think for Europeans, I mean, unlike the UK and France, the UK and France have their own independent nuclear forces, and we are spending very significant amounts of our defence budget on nuclear modernisation because we're building submarines, which are really expensive. But for the non-nuclear states who are really just dipping their toes in this nuclear business, the amounts of money aren't so great.
Thank you. And Paul?
Three quick points. The US B-61 program is for worldwide contingencies, certainly the Pacific and Europe too, but who knows where else. And everything I've heard suggests that that will go ahead for those worldwide factors. And it's not bound up with European decisions. Secondly, the argument of the extra cost of rewiring Eurofighters, I have observed, it's a tactic of desperation. When you're talking to officials or activists about the other programs, on that they start talking about money, but then when you home in, on, as Malcolm did, on the costs, it tends to be pretty unconvincing, and you can see that they're sort of looking for, grasping for arguments. The third point, I think, which engages more with your overall point, despite NATO being absolutely sure it's entering the age of austerity, and things really are very difficult for defence budgets, it is still committing itself to various conventional defence improvement programmes. There are things being built for infrastructure. There are improvements in tanks and all the spectrum of conventional military paraphernalia. How affordable that will be will very much depend upon the success of these reforms, the smart defence reforms, which are meant to deliver efficiencies which will allow things to be affordable which otherwise wouldn't be as defence budgets probably fall. And it's too early to tell how that exercise will work out. Although I come from a country which had declared that it had created smart procurement a few years ago, which has led to a complete procurement for catastrophe. smart procurement is perhaps not the smartest term to use because it sets up a lot of scepticism.
Thank you. Further questions? Well, if I may, I have a question to the two US panelists, which is just I was wondering if maybe you could sketch out what you see potentially, what impacts might a next Obama administration have on over the next few years for the atmospherics of the broader debate I was seeing in Europe regarding on how Europe should go about addressing non-strategic nuclear weapons. So be it either because of the way the Obama administration might look upon the issue of non-strategic nuclear weapons, but also the broader issue of nuclear disarmament and relationships with Russia. And in the same way, if you could sketch out what impact a Romney administration might have.
Well, let me start. I think the Obama administration, they've already put out the outline. When He signed the New START Treaty back in 2010. President Obama said there should be a further round of negotiations on further reductions with Russia. And he said you should bring into that not just deployed strategic warheads, which were limited by New START, but also non-deployed or reserve strategic warheads, and also non-strategic nuclear weapons. And the U.S. government is now thinking through how it might approach this next negotiation. But, you know, my sense is that there's at least a lean within the U.S. government towards the idea that the next U.S.-Russia round, if the Russians consent to a round and if President Obama is reelected, that next round should focus on a limitation that would capture all U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. Perhaps with a subsealing on the deployed strategic warheads, that would be analogous to the 1550 limit under New START. So I think there is that readiness to move forward. A big part of the question will be how willing the Russians are to negotiate.
I think in a if in a Romney administration, and again, a lot of it would depend on appointments, but I think you get back to something that looks more like the period between 2001 and 2009. You would have a much more mobilized, and remembering Romney, for example, you know, wrote opposing the New START Treaty ratification, doesn't know anything about these issues, but somebody wrote that for him, and actually that was a remarkable piece in and of itself because it would, had so many, like, actual factual flaws and everything else, but it gave a sense of where things were. So you would mobilize the disarmament communities in Europe in a way that they've been disarmed by Obama, because they thought, okay, you know, they were produced by Bush in a sense. Obama came in and said, okay, we got a guy who gets it. So now people are disappointed and stuff. But if Romney comes in and does what has been in the campaign discourse and what others in the party have done, you're going to mobilize those people in a way that creates stronger pressure to pull them out. The position on missile defense is fundamentalist in an evangelical way, which is going to then further alienate Russians and others. So you get a much more intense, perhaps, where these capabilities, this issue becomes more salient, but in no good way. All in negative ways. The nonproliferation kind of global apparatus again gets remobilized in a way that makes it, you know, fairly critical. Turkey, which has been actually very cooperative and kind of hanging back on these issues, depending on what that administration would do. And again, I mean, you have Senator Kyle, who basically, you know, was blocking the deployment or the move to put missile defense radars we wanted in Turkey. He was blocking it because they weren't making nice to Israel. And so, you know, you look at some of the rhetoric from some of the people advising Romney about Turkey, which is it's gone over to the axis of, it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, so now, so all of a sudden somebody gets elected and he goes, okay, now what's the world look like and what do I want? I mean, they may take a different view, but what the indications are and what people around town who advise these guys, what they say on this stuff is it's going to be back to an environment that was much more like 2004, 2005, I'd say.
Well, let me agree with everything that George has said, but then try to put a little bit more optimistic spin on it. And that is, and I think George is right, but I think what a Romney administration, if elected, might find is that there would be alliance management reasons to do things on non-strategic nuclear weapons and missile defense that they might not otherwise do. And my precedent for this would be go look at Ronald Reagan when he came to office in 1981. You know, the Reagan administration had a list of things to do in terms of nuclear weapons. It was revive the B-1 bomber. It was accelerate development deployment of the MX, intercontinental ballistic missile. Arms control was not high on that list, yet 7 months into the administration, a negotiation team led by Paul Nitze is in Europe negotiating on intermediate-range nuclear forces. And that was because they perceived correctly that without that negotiating effort, the deployment track, and this, the two-track decision in 1979 to deploy American missiles in Europe, while also negotiating on their perhaps reduction and elimination, you couldn't do the deployment track if you didn't have the limitation effort. And so You might have a similar dynamic here, as I think that some of those NATO countries that would like to see the American weapons go away are talking about it more in a consensus view within NATO because they see an administration that is committed to a negotiation. If they did not see that consensus or that administration on the American side prepared to that negotiation, would there be more of a tendency to consider unilateral steps? I don't know, but I think that would be one potential issue. Likewise, on missile defense, I think there is support in NATO for American missile defense deployments going forward with a big hope that it can be done in a cooperative way with Russia. And the administration gets credit for trying to seek that cooperative way, and with the failure to define a cooperative arrangement now seen as largely due to the Russian position. But again, what happens for European support for missile defense deployments if an American administration is perceived to be not committed to trying to find a cooperative arrangement? Again, I don't know, but there may well be some alliance pressures and some alliance management requirements that would lead the Romney administration to take a different position on these issues than it might otherwise be disposed to do. Hmm. And that's trying to be hopeful.
Yes, and so I have, now we have several figures. So we got two at the back and one at the front. Yes, we'll come forward.
Hi, Major Adam McSnitz, U.S. Army. I have a question about some of the maybe subordinate elements within DOD in your research. Does UCOM, Strategic Command, or the Air Force have any stake in these weapons at all? Are they lobbying to keep them, or do they just see them as a nuisance generally that they have to put up with?
Thank you. And actually, I'll take the two of the questions as well at the same time.
On a much different level, my name is Tom Emery. Assuming that Iran does achieve nuclear weapons, what relevance, if any, do any of you see European nuclear weapons having in what I understand is the administration's plan B, and that is to contain an Iranian nuclear power?
Thank you. And then here at the front as well, please.
Tom Goffis from the National Security Staff. It's related to that question, actually. Our post-Chicago, post-elephant birth that is going to happen, hopefully, leaves us with a scenario, I think, that you've assumed is pretty much current conditions moving forward, maybe a better economy, maybe less. I've heard that a little bit here, that relatively insensitive to the economy excursions. Mm. And then perhaps the French and the Germans go to their respective corners, perhaps even deeper on their positions, all of which would indicate, which makes it more difficult to change the posture in Europe rather than less. My question is, in addition to the Iranian nuclear scenario, are there other excursions that you looked at that could change the dynamics of the alliance enough to make a big change in the posture? A resurgent Russia, certainly the Baltic nations are afraid of what's going to happen with Putin and what's going on in Kaliningrad, things like that. Or, on the other hand, a positive scenario where we do find ways of cooperating on missile defense. And then maybe one more, just as an idea, would be something that happens with Syria, either positive or negative in the near future.
Yes, well, maybe should we go from Malcolm and coming okay.
In towards Paul? I don't feel qualified to answer the question in the U.S. Air Force. I'll leave that to my colleagues to answer. Iran, I think if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, it becomes a fully fledged nuclear weapon state with a tested weapon and so on, a lot is going to change. And this is not going to be very high in the list of responses. We would see, I think, much more investment in missile defense capability amongst Iran's neighbors, but also if they also continue to develop longer range ballistic missiles, much more focus on Iran in core NATO European countries like France and the UK. So that would be a big part of the response. I think it would have the political effect of perhaps making the timetable for withdrawing these American weapons in Europe rather more elongated. Not because I think people would think about them having a particular operational role in relation to Iran, because as George said before, I don't think that would be the case. But there would be a general sense that this is a setback for disarmament, which would make it more difficult. unless you had a scenario, and this is a big if, a lot would depend on how Russia played. If we get into a situation where, having for years the Russians have been telling us that we are overstating the Iranian threat, and Iran's much further behind in this, and not only in relation to weapons, but also in relation to missiles. So if in your scenario, which I don't necessarily think is the most likely one, but if your scenario arose and a powerful Iranian nuclear program was clearly underway, then how would the Russians react to that? And I think it's entirely possible that Russians would say, hang on, they hoodwink us as well. And if you get, if one impact of the rise of Iran in that scenario was NATO and Russia getting closer, then we'd have arrows pointing in two different directions in relation to NATO's European nuclear posture. So a lot depends on Russia. If you get into a scenario in which Russia got into bed with Iran, then we are in a really quite serious position. But I don't think that's, I think it's hard to read Russia going that direction. Russia continues to be critical in all this. In relation to other possible scenarios, it's clearly possible that Russia, for its own domestic reasons, or even because something goes wrong which they weren't planning for, you do get some sort of limited conflict between Russia and neighbors, or indeed you get a crisis in Belarus. I mean, some of the biggest problems aren't in NATO members and the Baltic states. There are issues about Russian minorities, which they may not be handling them in a perfect way, but I think that the trajectory is very much in the right direction. But what happens if there's a collapse in Belarus and you start getting responsibility to protect issues being raised in Western countries in relation to Belarus or indeed Ukraine? That's a scenario I would worry about Belarus. This is something Europeans, countries like Poland, care about, and they're not going to want to stand back, but Russia is not going to want us getting involved. The one thing the Russians have been paranoid about in the last 10 years is color revolutions. Well, who knows where the next color revolution is going to be? We certainly didn't predict in the Arab world there may be color revolutions in countries which Russia worries about much more. So that's something I'd worry about more than nuclear issues. I think a few more years down the road, there are issues of if Iran gets nuclear weapons, whether there's going to be a cascade in relation to Saudi Arabia. Personally, I don't think that's very likely, but it certainly can't be ruled out, and there's the Saudi-Pakistan dimension to talk about. But I think, as George said earlier, the acquisition of nuclear capabilities by countries with very severe conventional weaknesses, like Iran or indeed Pakistan going bad or other examples we could think of, it still leaves NATO with enormous conventional options for dealing with those problems. And it's hard to see how a sophisticated ladder of escalation in nuclear terms is necessary or indeed at all usable in those scenarios. Basically, these weapons, insofar as they have any operational role, it's in relation to a country with very substantial conventional capabilities. And there, today, in the foreseeable future, I think we're only talking about Russia and China.
I can take on the question of EUCOM and U.S. Air Force in Europe. I mean, there have been reports going back to the mid-1990s that the U.S. Air Force in Europe would like to see the weapons withdrawn. And I've had a couple of conversations the last couple of years with fairly senior American military officers who, when you ask them, do you see a military necessity for American nuclear weapons in Europe? And they believe that they can defend NATO territory with conventional forces, that nuclear weapons are not required. I guess it was about 2 years ago when then Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Cartwright, was asked, is there any role for nuclear weapons in Europe that could not be performed by either American conventional forces with long-range strike capabilities or U.S. strategic forces? And his very short but clear answer was no. So I think from the military's perspective, they don't see a military requirement. They will acknowledge that there may be separate political reasons, which get into questions like reassurance, but they don't see the military requirement. And I think there's a second consideration here from their perspective is, which is, if you're in the Air Force, U.S. Air Force Europe, and you're maintaining nuclear weapons, first of all, that's not a mission you're likely to do. I mean, so you're really trying to prepare for other missions that are far more likely. However, nuclear weapons are the one mission that you do not want to screw up on. And you need only to ask the commander of the B-52 unit that was up at Minot, and then work up the chain, including the Secretary of Air Force, that what happens when you fly six nuclear weapons unannounced from Minot down to Barksdale, Louisiana, and for 30 hours nobody knows that they're there. You know, this can be a career killer. So I think for a lot of military units, and I think the same thing applied to the U.S. Navy back in the 1990s, the U.S. Navy was delighted when the George H.W. Bush administration in 1991 said, we're going to withdraw all nuclear weapons from the Navy except for those weapons on ballistic missile submarines. And these guys said, that is great. That gives us more room to carry Harpoon missiles, you know, conventional Tomahawks, and we get rid of this huge set of requirements that we have to maintain, having responsibility for nuclear weapons, you know, that which just takes up a huge amount of the time. They're glad to see those requirements go away in the weapons, too.
George, do you have any concluding comments? Just on Iran, comments?
I mean, like I said earlier, and Malcolm, I mean, I don't think there's it's almost impossible to conceive of any, like, operational reason why NATO nuclear weapons would be necessary or useful to contain Iran, even if it had nuclear weapons and so on. But in terms of that and then your question, I mean, people in this town tend to think, well, the circumstance in which Iran would get nuclear weapons is kind of like what's happening now and they just keep going. Well, more likely circumstance is somebody bombs them in what is seen as an illegal aggression, you know, around the world and including Iran. And Iran then announces it's withdrawing from the NPT and explains to the UN Security Council, here's why we're withdrawing from the NPT. We were just attacked illegally by a country that has nuclear weapons outside the NPT. We're in the NPT. If that's the way the system's going to work, we're out. We're giving you our notice. And now you're in a different world where the legitimacy of nuclear weapons starts getting called into question, and U.S. policy, and as a guarantor with Israel and all of that, the politics in Germany. That's doesn't affect anything operationally, but the political environment in that situation gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Not in a good way.
Well, I think it's amusing. I mean, I look at it and I kind of go, you know.
We know what you mean by interesting, Joe.
Yeah, you know, UN sanctions on Israel. I mean, that's an interesting debate. You know, so that's interesting.
No, I was referring to the Iranian.
No, I know. Yeah.
Yes, and
on the Iranian thing, I mean, I agree that would be an interesting scenario. But it would be interesting for this question because it would make the whole European debate about what to do about these weapons quite left-right divided, I think. Yeah. In one sense, it makes the vision of a world going down to zero pretty unlikely. On the other hand, whose fault was that? So this could become a more toxic issue in national security policy. On USAF, I've met maybe an issue of what USAF thinks about these weapons. There may be an issue of levels here. I've met colonels who fly fighter bombers who insist actually there is a damn good reason for keeping them. But when I ask them what that was, they say they can't tell me. So we tried to construct what that was on page 9. You're quite right at sort of general level. I think that's everything. That fits everything I've read. But I also hear it reported that in this kind of discussion, the OSD has an attitude, you know, which is we don't care what you. These are not your weapons. Right. They're presidential weapons. Yeah. So shut up. At what level would the issue be divided? I don't know. And on Russia, I guess there's a general truth here that any sharpening of antagonism, wherever it comes, Belarus or Syria, is going to block progress on a consensual agreement about the future of non-strategic nuclear weapons. And conversely, any major rapprochement will make it easier.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you. The Carnegie report, which was authored by the panel, stresses that over the next few years, although, of course, a lot of the discussions on the future of NATO's non-strategic nuclear weapons will take place within the alliance, it will be key for there to be many public debates as well, parallel to this, to ensure that the debates within NATO don't just stagnate and then at the end burst out into the open, into public disputes, which will then lead to quite suboptimal outcomes. So hopefully today has been an important contribution to this debate, and we will be having many more of them. And all that is left to me then to do is to thank you very much to have joined us this afternoon, and to ask you also to thank our panelists for their thoughts.